Welcome to episode 10 of the Frontal Harvest Podcast.
A podcast about science, technology, and education, and marijuana.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick, and together we are the hosts of the Frontal Harvest Podcast.
Great. I'll start with the administration stuff. So today we are recording May 21st for our podcast that will be posted Sunday the 24th. So today we're trying new headsets, so you may have a lot of variation in the volume because we're trying these new things out for the first time. And
nope, I'm going to adjust down just a bit as I'm noticing this. And I'm really liking the sound of these.
Yeah, I think the sound will be much better, and hopefully the quality of the podcast will improve.
It's funny, when we had the last headset, I was really, oh, you know, this is really wild. You know what I just realized?
What?
We can turn and talk to each other.
Yes, yeah. I just realized that too. Yeah. We and used to all face that.
Yeah, we had to always face away, and now yeah. We can talk. And because these are headsets,
right?
So we have two instead of having this thing hanging down between us,
right?
So this is a lot nicer.
Yeah, and we each have individual mics, so hopefully the sound quality will be much improved. So,
Okay.
So, yeah, what is that?
That's Isaac's setup.
So oh, yeah. So our podcast currently and our webpage is hosted at frontalharvest.ddns.net. And we had posted it on our local server as a way of test running this whole blog and setting up our podcast. And we told our older son about it, and he set up a web page, which was wonderful and scary. And so now we feel like, wow, what have we done? But it's exciting.
Yeah, we're out there.
Yeah, we're out there.
Even more. We were kind of like out there last time, but now we really, really.
Now we're really, really, really out there. Yep. And so that's our new thing this time. And Patrick has spent a lot of time updating the pictures on our blog. So now that most of our blog entries have images to go with it, which is really exciting and makes it much more interesting. So, we'll start with our blog entries. And Patrick, how about you talk about ARTIF?
Okay. One last thing, administratively.
Oh, okay.
We have, I think we're going to do a new section.
Okay.
Called Minor Topics. We talked about this.
Oh, yeah.
But I guess you really don't want to do this.
Because, no, I do. I don't know how I forgot it. I just, my eyes slipped over it.
Anyway, so yeah, we found that the last few times, it feels like we had discussions that went on for like 5 to 10 minutes about some topics. Mm-hmm. And then, I have to say, I love being able to turn to you and talk to you.
Yeah, it makes it that I can actually communicate.
The new headsets. Mm-hmm. But anyway, and then we had other things that we talked about, and we only had just two sentences to say. Mm-hmm. But it's stuff that we thought was really neat, we discovered, and we were like, oh, so we're going to group all these together.
Yeah, it's kind of like our quick find section.
Yeah.
You know, those things that you find and you're like, whoa, I never knew.
Right. So. And then we'll go into the topics. But first, the blog entries.
Okay.
So I guess I should do mine. So I did mine on some progress we made with ARDF equipment building and experiments. And but it was specifically one really neat thing that a system we came up with. And we're going to talk more about like experiments stuff later, because we did one driving out in the car and stuff. But this is just the blog. And the question is, when you're experimenting, you want to be able to turn what you're seeing into numbers. Mm-hmm. So you can plot them and look at them and be like, okay, you know, this is the data, and you can start to make some more intelligent choices about where to go next, and a better understanding of the theory, you know, what's happening. And so how do you quantitate these radio signals?
Right.
And we don't have a way to do any absolute quantitation right now. Mm-hmm. But we found a really neat way to quantify the stuff in a relative way. And basically, I had set up one of the transmitters and had it sending a signal out, mm-hmm. and then a receiver. And the receiver, instead of listening to it, I had a line going from the output of the receiver directly into the record input of my
Audacity.
Laptop.
Yeah.
And exactly. And mm-hmm. Audacity was running on the laptop. And then it's really neat. If you select a section with Audacity, then you can go to oh, I can't remember what it's called. It's something like analysis and then plot spectrum, I think.
Right.
And then you can see the whole Fourier transform, and you can see all the noise, and then you can see a big peak. And we tested to make sure, and so you see this peak, so that's your fundamental frequency. And boy, this is the blog, so I can talk about it for now. That's right. I'm like, this is more than just a minor. So if in Audacity, if you hover your pointer over the spectrum, then it'll snap.
Okay. Yeah? So spectrum, what do you mean by spectrum?
So when you look at a waveform, you see pressure going up and down, mm-hmm. right? And so that's a certain note, pure note, would be a sine wave with a certain mm-hmm. frequency. So that's looking at a waveform in the time domain, they say. Basically, okay. Time's on the x-axis. And a Fourier analysis converts that to what's called the frequency domain. Mm-hmm. So on the x-axis, you have frequencies. Mm-hmm. And on the y-axis, you have the power, meaning how much of that frequency is part of your signal.
Right.
So when you look at Audacity, there's a bunch of stuff at the bottom, and it covers all frequencies, and it gets louder at the lower frequencies. So that's just noise. But then you have a single peak at a particular frequency, and that's basically the sine wave that's going along that you're recording. Mm-hmm. And if you hover your mouse over that peak, then on the bottom on the right of the window, it'll tell you, it'll snap to the center of the peak, or the highest point on the peak, mm-hmm. I guess, and it'll tell you what's that frequency, and it'll tell you the power.
Oh, nice.
That's in that peak. So we tested this by, I just had the transmitter going into a mm-hmm. dummy load, and then the receiver on the desk, moving it back a little over 100 centimeters from it, and you could see the audio level drop, which was... And you could see frequencies change, which is interesting, but you could see the audio level drop as you moved it away. So, you know, this is kind of like, if we wanted to test two different things, we'd have a relative way to measure the difference mm-hmm. and plot them both. The other thing that's neat, well, go ahead.
Before you go on, yeah. I want to mention that Patrick has put the graph and different graphs up that he's talking about now, as well as images of his experimental setup and the Audacity screenshot, so you can look at that and kind of follow along with what he's saying.
Yeah. Part of our new plan to try to get pictures with mm-hmm. every blog entry.
Oh, exactly. But since they really coincide with what you're saying right now, I just want to make sure that people can see it if they want to.
Yeah. And so it's kind of neat. You can get this frequency. And what's really neat is if you have a pure sine wave, which is basically what the signal should be, then you get a single peak. Mm-hmm. But if it's not a pure sine wave, then you have to add higher frequency sine waves to it to change the shape. And so you get other peaks to the right. And I don't have that a picture of that on the blog entry. But what's really neat about that is if you're sending too much power... I'm going to have to move this a bit. I was actually touching... Oh, it's not staying up. There we go. Better check this. Sorry about the audio mess up here. I think I'm... Did I go down suddenly? Anyway, it looks like I'm down. Can you say something?
Well,
No, that looks good.
No, you still look like okay. You're okay.
Okay. Anyway, so getting back to the... Yeah, so if you have this sine wave, then you get a single peak. But if you're trying to feed too much signal into the record port on your computer, then Audacity will clip the top of the sine wave, and the more it gets clipped, the more it looks like a square wave. And so you can see peaks show up at higher frequencies. So you don't even need to stretch out your audio signal, you know, in the time domain. Basically, when I look at it, it just looks like bars wherever the signal's coming, and then a thin line when there's no signal. If I stretched it out, I could see a sine wave, and I could see whether it's clipped or not. But I don't even need to do that, because I can look at the spectrum, and if there's no other higher peaks, I know that's a sine wave in there. Mm-hmm. That if I stretched it out, then
right.
I could see the sine wave. So that's really cool.
Yeah, that is.
Anyway, so we started to do that with some other experiments, testing solenoids and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it's a real cool, easy way to quantify your measurements.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So that's pretty much all I wanted to say about the blog. Like, we're going to have more to talk about the ARDF. But
yeah.
That's
and you're going to talk about us being on the road collecting data with your setup in the back of the car?
Well, that's going to be part of our major topics.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Didn't mean to steal it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. No
experiments.
Spoilers. Ah, great. Okay. So my blog entry was on... actually a volunteer project that we worked on with the Carolina Climbers Coalition. And basically, we went to one of our favorite climbing areas, Moore's Wall. It's about an hour and a half from our home. And it's a place that we run away to as often as we can.
Yeah.
We've done it more. Actually 2 years ago, and now we're trying to reclaim our climbing, and it's a little slower because there's several things competing right now, but we're both excited about getting back into it. Yeah, definitely. So what we did is we noticed on the...
Oh, you know what we should say?
What?
My blog entry was number 19.
Oh, okay.
And yours is number 20. It'll
yes.
make it really easy for people to just suddenly go to the webpage and click.
Great.
So we're
yes.
doing blog entry number 20.
We're doing blog entry number 20 now.
Yep.
And so basically we showed up for a trail day in early May, and there was a group of 25 of us that built a trail and redirected a trail around Moore's Wall. And it was heavy work.
It sure was.
It was like a full day. You're like 6 hours going steady with just small breaks for maybe a drink of water and a quick lunch. And you are back digging out roots and digging rocks out and replacing them. But it was a great experience. We met wonderful people who enjoy climbing as well. Many of them were like us. Either they didn't have children, or their children had moved on and they had a little more time to volunteer like this and to work on a trail on weekends. And
it was neat, like meeting all different people and stuff. Like,
yeah,
I don't necessarily meet people very easily.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did a lot of work by myself, but you got to talk to people and
oh yeah,
just neat. And we were all... Most of the time, we were all off in totally different areas.
Right.
Like, we split up very early.
Yeah, we didn't intend to, but no. We just didn't stick
together.
Like, I wasn't
wanting necessarily right. to be next to each other, but
right.
it's just the fact that you're on a trail, and it's got to be person after person. There's not a right. space anywhere for two people.
Right, and you're trying to, like...
And, yeah.
You get sucked into doing, you know, the digging out the roots, yeah. and so you focus on that, or you get stuck... You know, pulling out rocks and replacing rocks, and it just happens on that part of your trail, and it becomes your job.
Yep.
And it was a nice day. It was something that I'd definitely do again, and I just felt really good about doing it. It's like, wow, this is a place I really love, and it's nice to do something for an area you're going to return to, and you hope other people would enjoy.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And the part you mentioned about the mats of organic matter, that was the most surprising.
I had no idea that you could have 4 inches of root mass. It was like, what is that?
And do you remember, I don't know if you mentioned it in your blog intro or not, but when we went to the Amazon,
mm-hmm.
I distinctly remember... having, maybe we talked about this already, actually. Did we talk about this and stuff we've done in the last blog?
No.
Oh, we hadn't done it yet.
No.
Wow, this is giving me so much deja vu. It's weird. Anyway, I distinctly remember walking around, and you had some leaves and stuff, but it was absolutely just dirt underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And when we pulled up those mats, when we were at Moore's Wall, it just went on and on. And then you got to a spot where there's no question, it's just dirt, there's no...
Mm-hmm.
And it looked exactly to me like it did in the Amazon.
Yeah.
Except it's a whole 2 feet, well, maybe not 2 feet, but at least a foot in some places mm-hmm. of organic matter here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That was
like,
wild.
It was, you had to, I used a McLeod, and I was hammering and twisting.
Technical term.
Yeah, technical term. So it's like a heavy-duty rake with a hoe end, but that it's made so that it would be difficult to destroy.
Yeah.
So if you hit the odd rock, it's not going to totally destroy the rake or the hoe. And it was just like, sometimes you're just digging in one spot for like 15 minutes straight just to get down to the bottom.
Are you sure we didn't talk about this last time? I bet you we did.
Really?
Maybe for a short while.
Okay, we'll leave it
no,
shorter.
No, but this is good because yeah. it's your blog entry.
Yeah.
It's okay to...
Okay, so...
You know, I thought one thing we could do in the future after we have many things, some stuff's going to keep coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be neat to have a section that would be... like a retour de mm-hmm. Moore's Wall or
yeah.
something,
mm-hmm.
where you're revisiting a topic simply because there's nothing necessarily big or new. You just went looking to see what's the current state of,
mm-hmm.
you know, whatnot. And it'll be interesting because when you listen to the podcast from one time to another, you get used to certain topics,
mm-hmm.
you know? Anyway.
Yeah. So great, great place to visit, and hopefully you'll get out there and enjoy the trail and get
yep.
some climbing.
Yep. One last thing.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't take any pictures.
We did not of the trail, and
yeah.
and it wouldn't have been possible when we were there.
Well, we decided we didn't want to bring the camera because we just wanted to focus on helping out.
Right.
So.
Right. And so we were trying to make it.
We'll get some pictures in the future.
Yeah.
When we go back sometime.
When we go by, we can take pictures of the trail that we worked on so that...
That'll be fun.
We can
yeah.
add it to our blog.
So I did find some old pictures from
mm-hmm.
2013.
Yep.
Which I put up on your blog entry. But that's all I had, actually.
Mm-hmm. Makes me want to get out climbing again.
Yeah, me too.
So
this is Memorial Day coming up?
Memorial Day,
yeah,
yes.
So we're probably not going to go.
Yeah, it'll be...
I think we decided
yeah.
just to stay off the roads.
Roads, yeah.
I mean, it's like we have tons of stuff to do at home, so...
Mm-hmm. Yep. So we're going to start with some minor topics that we have. And Patrick is going to start us off with going live with DDNS.net.
Yeah, so, I mean, these are going to be just really short, mm-hmm. right?
Oh, yeah. So I have a bunch that I want to mention, too.
Isaac set up frontalharvest.ddns.net for us.
Mm-hmm.
Instantly, I was like, oh, my gosh, so what can we find out about people connecting and stuff? And the way I understand it is I had to set up, the way Isaac told me, port forwarding through our router.
Mm-hmm.
So the server for our web page right now is actually at home. It's not some hosting site.
Okay.
And it's running Apache.
Mm-hmm.
And Apache logs the stuff onto the computer. And I looked at it, and man, is that complicated, all this stuff.
Oh, I bet.
So that's, but it was neat. You can see, mm-hmm. and all these connections that I don't know where they came from, so I'll have to ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
Another one was a new tool chain for plotting that I've been testing out. I tend to plot stuff out of spreadsheets because it's so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good way to visualize stuff. But spreadsheets are a real pain when you have to do any kind of recursive computation or something that's more complicated than you can do with tables.
Mm-hmm.
And I use programs that I write more than anything when it comes to that. But I've used Scilab some.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was working on getting Scilab to send the data, well, through a text file, I guess, to GNUplot to plot the data. And I started working on that. And I don't know, I haven't gotten too far, but it's a neat way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I might keep that up. I tried to download one of our web pages.
Yeah.
Through the thing. So it took 9 minutes and 15 seconds to download.
Right.
I have it on here. One of our... Well, it wasn't the web page. The web page comes up.
It was
really
the
fast.
Podcast.
It was the podcast. Mm-hmm. Right? And it was 7.5 megabytes. So that's really... It's going to make us look much sooner than we expected for a hosting site.
Right. And that's been on the docket for a while, yeah, for us.
I think we'll wait until after school's over.
I think we will, because we want to get something. We're always saying we just want to make sure it's the one we want. But soon we're going to do it. And I guess we're wading into this whole podcast thing.
Yep.
You know, first in the home, now getting a little more live,
well,
but
you know,
more difficult to access.
From the very beginning, it was accessible outside,
mm-hmm.
but you had to go through the Raspberry Pi.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So let's see. I talked about OpenSCAD
mm-hmm.
A while ago in one of our podcasts. And I started work on that, so stuff's going to come there soon, I think. It's neat. So basically, OpenSCAD is a way to use a programming language to make 3D objects.
Mm-hmm.
And people use it for 3D printing.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking that.
And I used it for the desk,
mm-hmm.
the top of
yeah,
the desk.
Yeah, to make the top of the desk structure.
Yeah. But... basically, writing little modules that you can reuse is absolutely the best way to go,
mm-hmm.
because it's a lot more powerful in a way than making something that you can manipulate with a mouse and turn it and stuff. But since you have to type it in, it's harder in a way to get going initially.
Mm-hmm.
So having many little modules that you wrote. So that's...
You also used it for making little icons for your posters, for when you're going to that conference.
Actually, I used it to make a model of one of our culture devices.
Right, right.
And the reason was because then I was going to have 3D printed a jig to mm-hmm. put that together.
Right.
And that never happened.
Okay.
But then it also makes fun little images.
Right.
So I just took a screenshot.
Use that image.
Yeah. So I've been using Git on and off. Actually, every single day now.
I know. I was about to say on and off. What?
And one thing I think I realized, this is really weird. I think, I'm not certain, but I think that the files are stored separately from the file names and the paths. And the reason I say that is because I changed a file name.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to, I did git add star to add all the changes in, and git dash add dash u, which also removes files that you've taken out. And then I did git commit to finalize the changes. It reported back not that a file had been deleted and that another one had been created, but that it had changed name. And I said, how does it know that?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
It must store this, it must look up the hash value for the files, but the hash value must just be the contents.
Okay.
And what's weird
and when you
about,
say the hash value for the file, you just mean the file name?
So you know when we downloaded Raspbian?
Mm-hmm.
And then we also got an MD5 sum.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ran MD5 on the stuff we downloaded. And it had to match
right.
that text, whatever. That's a hash value.
Okay, got it.
And somehow I think it uses hash values to store stuff. But I don't know. I don't totally understand it. I'll have to look at it into it more because I thought that the files were stored with a header or something describing it. So, let's see. I found a new Vim command, which is incredible.
Is this the one you were telling Luke about?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
No. Oh, that's something else if you want to. I found this thing called Vim Adventure.
Oh, got it. I was like, hold it.
Someone
you did something
had mentioned
with Vim.
It. Yeah. But that's something else. That's just a fun web page.
Yeah.
No. So this command, it's basically a sequence of keystrokes that you can put in your vimrc file, which loads up every time you start Vim. And I have it assigned to F12. I don't know. You must have seen in so many of my text files, I have a long line, which is like 55 underscores, and then the date always in the same format.
Right.
So I have it now that...
In the European format?
No.
Oh, okay.
It's the ISO. It's the only format that makes any sense. But let's not go into that. But check this out. So I just opened Vim, right?
Yeah.
I move up a bit. I hit F12. And... I didn't put it on this computer. But basically, on the computer I work, I just do that, and it instantly adds
puts
that whole
your,
line,
oh, okay.
looks up the date, and it does it in the format.
Oh, nice. To start your journal of that day or of the material that you're gathering.
Yeah,
Very nice.
So,
that's handy.
I started to use Chuck, which is... so you don't know about this at all.
Vim Chuck's widow.
Vim Chuck's widow. Well, it is an audio program.
Okay.
It's for making music and stuff.
Oh, neat.
And I just started to fiddle with it.
Oh, nice.
And have not been able to get it to work.
Okay.
And it's just been an absolute nightmare looking up stuff. And I haven't spent a lot of time on it.
And what put you over to Chuck? What was the...
So it's interesting for making music. Maybe I can make something for our podcast.
Yeah.
A little intro, exit music.
But
actually, it was like I wanted a sound recorded of a particular tone, of several tones, that I could listen to.
Oh, for the radio.
Yeah.
Got it.
Because
got it.
I've got a feeling if we're going to have to make all sorts of measurements and we're moving closer, it might be interesting to have it always set at the same tone, which means there'll have to be an adjustment. And so I was thinking, okay, if I mark it on the dial, that's going to move all over, right? Because that changes. But if I can listen to a tone in one ear and then, like just from an MP3 player, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pure tone, and then I move the dial on the receiver for the radio signal until I get that same tone, I think the ear is accurate enough. If you hear both at the same time, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'll know within a fraction of a hertz if I'm above or below.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I can adjust it exactly.
Oh, that's
and
good.
And then we can take a measurement like
neat.
That. So I thought,
neat.
That's what originally got me to it. You know, mm-hmm. I'm sure there's a ton of ways to do that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always been interested in Chuck. I just don't have time to look at it usually. And so I looked at it. And it turned out to be a lot more work than I thought. And I still don't have it working. It's like the Raspberry Pi camera.
I know. That Raspberry Pi camera.
Okay, my last one. Ultra Mini Rank. I cannot stand things like...
That's a mini rant. I'm teasing you.
A mini rant plus all of this things like LibreOffice and AbbeyWord and stuff that start up with autocorrect on.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't even mind that if you could just go to the settings and
turn it off.
Autocorrect and click off. Mm-hmm. But it's like a million different places, it seems like, you have to look to mm-hmm. find. And I think I shut it off, and yeah, okay, it's not correcting messages. And then I type in two dashes, and it instantly converts it to some
autocorrect.
Unicode
mm-hmm.
symbol, which is fine, but that's not what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it does this continuously, and it's just driving me crazy. Anyway.
Yeah.
So no, I'm done with that. Anger.
Yep, I can totally relate to that, especially with programs that want to do that.
Hey, Luke.
Hey, Luke.
No, you can come in.
No, it's okay.
Wait, I'm pausing it, right? Okay, we just had a little pause, and we're back. That was our son, Luke, that came back.
Yeah, looking for supper.
Ooh, you're very far, Kelly. I'm not getting you on here.
Oh, sorry. There. Am I back on?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's good. So I'm going to... I might try to find where that was around 30 minutes or so, but I might not get it. Not sure. I'll make sure this is good.
Okay.
Okay. So...
So now I...
Where were we? We were...
So you just finished your rant.
Ah, so we're on to...
So I'm on to my... My little things that I found.
Oh, your
my minor things. Topics.
Okay.
So, I was looking up many things and I came across this biosensing, device that they can set in the spinal column to control chronic pain. And of course, it's not being used yet. They're just starting to develop it, or they think they have the prototype.
That's and the thing you showed me earlier.
Yeah, it's the one I showed you yesterday. And it's just, I thought it was, we're both looking at the device. It looks like a little needle mm-hmm. that somehow is lodged close by the spinal column.
Yeah.
And we're both looking at going, how long would it be, you know, useful for? How many, you know, when would you have to have it replanted, or how long
because it
could
sounds
you expect?
Like, I mean, when you have an epidural, there's always the risk of infection.
Yeah.
So it seems like with that device, you'd want to have it, you know, sealed in under the skin.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, definitely. It looked like it would have been
sealed
into
in
the
underneath.
Skin. Yeah. So, very interesting. It'll be great if it helps people, with chronic pain, because that's, and having something that is, electronically controlled to help administer the drugs for them, using some biological signals. So, interesting, neat way of combining. It is an inhibitor of neurotransmitter. It is, how do you say that, Pat?
GABA.
GABA?
Gamma-aminobutyric acid.
Yeah.
I remember I had to study it for my physiology doctorate.
Yeah, so really neat stuff. And to
It's a large part of the CNS. I don't remember exactly where, but all through the CNS, it's, and I think it's always inhibitory.
Mm-hmm. And it's just, I thought it was a cool connection of bioelectronics and these devices being put in the medical field.
So did you get to see what's the sensing part? Like, does it have a sensor?
Let me look at it again. I just have to. Yep.
Okay. I had a little pause. We're just interrupted again.
Yeah. So the device looks like it goes right into the spinal column, like in the center of the spinal column. And
actually, it's marked on the page there, L3 through L6.
Mm-hmm. So it would be, we're just commenting about, you know, you'd have to be really careful so that you don't contaminate the area.
Well, yeah, and but the other thing I was wondering is, it's supposed to have a sensor, is that right?
Yeah, an internal electrode. Maybe that's it.
Anyway.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. It's something that I hope to hear more about.
And it was in Science?
It was in Science. And it was
or Science
just,
Advances.
Yeah.
That's their open source journal. I mean, open, what do you call it? It's not open source. It's open access. That's
open access, yeah. So I thought it was worth mentioning. The other article that I thought was interesting was the Canadian Registry, or there's a group of scientists that are going to start collecting data on the use of marijuana in Canada. And they're going to track 3,000 people. And these are like chemotherapy patients, people with wasting conditions, and people with multiple cirrhosis, and looking to see the effects and if they can actually, if they can understand how it is used and when it is most beneficial to think more about true doses.
So, what's the drug? Tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, is that? I can't remember.
I'm not sure.
So, but these people are actually smoking, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I understood. And this is a 10-year study that's just been launched in Canada, so it'll go on to 2025.
Well, I'm looking at your page here, and I'm seeing medicinal cannabis research.
Yeah.
At the Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research.
Right.
Huh.
So what I thought was kind of interesting is it's starting to be legalized in some states.
Yeah.
And yet we don't really have much evidence about what, what it is or how it's being
let
used.
Let me pause it. Okay. We are back again.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. I mean, this is like interruption after interruption. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah.
So pretty cool. The other...
Oh, wait a second. That's at the University of California, San Diego.
Well, it's actually... some of the information is from there, but the study is being done in Canada. McGill is one of the universities that's involved in the study.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So the other thing I thought was kind of interesting this week, I have to make sure, we have some researchers that are close to engineering yeast that make morphine.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's kind of cool, and they're pretty close to being able to do that. There's some controversy about that because they're like, wow, you know, what are the controls on the yeast once you get them to the stage that they're producing morphine?
Well, that looks, and morphine looks pretty complicated.
Yeah. And
how is it made? Is it isolated from plant or is it actually synthetically made? I don't know. It looks really nasty for trying to make it
right
with organic chemistry.
Right.
It's because it's got all these ring structures that...
So, from what I understand, it's a plant-based chemical, but of course with the poppy, because it comes from the poppy plant.
Yeah, originally it's an opiate.
Originally, but I do not know if, you know, how, if they're synthetically manufacturing it as well as growing it, so.
But I guess the big question was the point of getting yeast to make it a way to help in the manufacture of morphine?
Yes.
Okay.
So it was a different alternative. It was supposed to be much cheaper than the other alternatives they have to producing morphine. Okay. So it's supposed to be a very cheap, efficient way of doing that.
Gotcha.
Cheap and easy. So there's controversies because, of course, they don't want this supporting a drug market, like a
I guess the
illegal drug market.
Yeah, I was about to say, I guess,
so that's
how much of a step is it from morphine to some of the more, well, some of the drugs that are more ones that you find on the street.
Right.
I guess, would heroin be an opium? I don't know.
So, interesting. The other thing that I was looking up, because Patrick was telling me about the super volcano, and he was, and we had to look up what, you know, Yellowstone Park and the super volcano. And so I started looking up more things tonight. There wasn't a whole lot of information, but tonight when I was looking up things, it was funny because apparently this summer there is a huge social media thing going on with Yellowstone Park and the super volcano that they were giving misinformation. And so it was really hard for the park to clarify.
The super volcano is one of our main topics.
Oh, is it? Oh, I'm sorry. So this part that I looked up today was just the part about what the park has as information out there. And it's been very difficult for them to provide the information about Yellowstone Park and the super volcano with that people are accepting, and they're accepting more of the social media hype that's misinformation instead. So I thought it was kind of interesting.
What kind of misinformation is?
Okay, so the misconception, when Yellowstone erupts, it'll be Armageddon.
Oh my God.
And so
it's the end of the world. I can feel it coming.
Right. And the other
That's
one.
That's okay. That's okay. There's a comet coming by, and I'm in touch with aliens. And Yellowstone's going to blow, but it's okay because we're going to be spirited up with the comet. Yes.
And the Yellowstone magma chamber is growing. That's the other misconception. And Yellowstone is overdue for a super eruption. And the Yellowstone is rapidly rising. And so they have this whole USGA page that really goes over all of the misconceptions that were put out there in the social media that really misled many people about what's happening at Yellowstone.
So let's finish this up because I don't have a ton more.
Okay.
But this all got started because of an article in the AAAS Science on May 15th. I mean, not all this, the hype.
No, not all the...
Our interest in
the social, yeah. The social media started last summer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this has nothing to do with that.
No, it has nothing to do.
But some researchers, they used some kind of a new system, and I didn't look at it carefully. And they imaged the magma chambers, I guess, under Yellowstone, and they found this that it was divided into two mm-hmm. different chambers. And if I understand, I'm trying to go by memory. I might
have this
wrong. Yeah,
I'm looking for the pictures now for you.
You know, Hawaii is over just the ocean crust. Mm-hmm. And they describe that as the mafic crust, M-A-F-I-C.
Mm-hmm.
But on the continents, you have the lighter felsic crust on top of that.
Right.
So they were saying, okay, so Yellowstone has this magma that came up because it's a hot spot like Hawaii, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it builds up in two layers, the mafic crust and the felsic crust.
Mm-hmm.
And they found this big area that they didn't know about before this time in the lower mafic crust. What I thought was fascinating was the mechanism by which you get these gigantic explosions at Yellowstone
mm-hmm.
and why you don't get them at places like Hawaii.
Right.
And they had the record of how much of the stuff gets spewed out by these mm-hmm. volcanoes over time. And actually, Hawaii is much higher than Yellowstone.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that when Yellowstone blows, it's a catastrophe, while when Hawaii blows, it's just a small eruption.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, to the people living there, it'd be like, what? A small eruption? But basically, Hawaii's constantly erupting and letting out magma. And what was really fascinating is their theory about why this happens at Yellowstone and the other two major ones in the world are, there's one in Indonesia.
And one in New Zealand.
That's right, in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And the theory is that, okay, there's so much more crust, right, and over Yellowstone. So it comes up and it forms this magma in the mafic crust, but that's not going to blow because there's still the felsic crust above that.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of it goes up above and you have chambers in the felsic crust. But because you have so much on top, it doesn't blow for a really long time. And the magma that came up from the mantle, because it's sitting there for so long, it actually separates. And the part that ends up in the higher felsic crust
mm-hmm.
is lighter.
Right, and less dense.
And less dense, but part of that is that it has a lot of volatile gases. So that when it does blow, it expands very quickly and
mm-hmm.
blows everything apart. While the stuff in at Hawaii just kind of oozes out more.
Right.
So,
right.
Anyway, it was really an interesting mechanism.
Yeah.
But I don't think I think it's just a theory.
Right. So. Right. And you know, like anything, it's an ongoing research project.
Yeah.
And we don't have a huge number of super volcanoes that, or records of them with the current equipment that we have today.
Yeah, yeah.
And so all of that combined makes it very difficult.
It's a cool mechanism, though.
Yeah, it is.
Maybe you can model it in your classroom.
There's just not enough vinegar. What's the other thing that I wanted to mention? There's one other thing.
These are still... We went off to the super volcano, but...
Yep.
But you were still on your small stuff.
Yeah, that was, yeah.
Is that the end
That's
of
the end of my small stuff.
Okay.
So what are some topics of interest that you had this week, Patrick?
I only have two that were kind of specifically mine.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'll do India first.
Okay.
Because
India, I really wanted to know a lot more about, and I didn't get a chance to dig into it this week.
Because we made quite a bit of progress in figuring out how to set up the antennas and stuff, and
mm-hmm.
but some of that we did together. So
okay,
I'll move into that. So the India one. Did I put the fish on there? Yes, I did.
Yes, you did.
So we'll do that mm-hmm. later because we talked about that. a lot together. Yeah. So this was just a news article. It was in Nature.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting how India's changed. I guess, I don't know, in around the year 2002 or so, I don't know if it was really popular to do work on genetically modified crops in India, or if it just happened to be a few groups, but something happened that someone got GM cotton,
mm-hmm.
Accepted as an insect, anti-insect type of crop,
mm-hmm.
and it got adopted, and it's been fantastically successful.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that nowadays even, India is the fourth largest producer of GM crops.
That's amazing. I just had no idea.
Yeah, and it's almost all the cotton.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even more amazing when I explain what else happened. Just as a note, the other three are U.S., Brazil, and Argentina,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, U.S.
Why would it? U.S. makes sense, I guess.
Corn, soy.
Yeah.
Brazil
and Argentina. Huh.
I bet you they're doing soy. Maybe corn. I don't know.
You can see the attraction to GM crops in mm-hmm. India because of their population problem.
Right. But it's not being used as a food crop.
Well, so this was early on, 2002, mm-hmm. right?
Okay, got it.
And I'm sure some people were thinking, as soon as we get some food on there. But in 2010, I guess, a bunch of anti-GM crop activists and farmers got together, and they had these large protests, public protests, and there was a big field trial that was going to go on
mm-hmm.
for... what was the crop? It's called, I can't remember. Anyway, it was a particular, brinjal. I have it mm-hmm. here on my notes. And they got the trial banned. And so, obviously, India has a huge population to feed and it's mm-hmm. growing. Here's something amazing. There's 100 million farmers in India.
See, that's just mind blowing.
Yeah.
100 million.
Yeah.
What's the population of the United States?
300 million, about.
Yeah. So a third of the population.
Actually,
of the
it's
United
more
States.
Than 300 million in the United States. But yeah, just more than a third of all farmers.
Mm-hmm.
They must be small farms. But
yeah.
So their worries, make a lot of sense. And they're like,
mm-hmm.
hey. We go to GM crops, they're going to outcompete us. We're going to have to buy all of our crops from these companies.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, 319 million in the U.S. in 2014. Okay, so not too far. So they're worried. And, I think it makes sense for them to be worried. I still think it makes even more sense to go ahead and experiment with GM crops, mm-hmm. even though there's worries. But anyway, so in 2010, that trial got banned, and then the government started to legislate, to enact all this legislation to make it more restrictive. And basically, at one point, they gave the states the right to veto any field trials. And then pretty much after that, I guess there's a lot of research in India at Indian universities, and some mm-hmm. of the researchers, I guess they were saying at that point, it was basically like, well, we're going to have to find something else to do.
Yeah.
Because if you can't get to the, you can still do the research in your lab, I guess, but then what? If you can't put it to the field, you never know whether your crop is really ever going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they have a new prime minister in India for the last, he got voted in about a year ago, Narendra Modi,
mm-hmm.
And I guess he's been quietly pushing the GM stuff and changing the legislation. And now there's 8 states. They were saying those are mostly states aligned with his party, but 8 states that are allowing trials again.
Wow.
So that's kind of cool. Interesting to see if he was pushing it quietly and now it starts to take off, whether the protests will go through the roof again or if it's just going to keep going and people are over their worries, you know.
Yeah. Interesting. Yep. I think it's, I'm really interested in this area. This is an area that I want to dig into because I'm really trying to weigh the value of GM crops and to really better understand the implementation of them and how it's being done.
You know,
throughout the world. So
in my mind, there's no question that there's fantastic value in all of these.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there are certain societal pressures that will push societies to go in a particular direction, and certain technologies will make it worse. So monocrop cultures are considered really bad, and yet we can't help ourselves because it's economics, right? And GM crops will, it seems, will tend to make that possibly worse, but maybe not. I don't know, maybe in the future it'll be a way on the contrary to increase diversity, but right now it doesn't seem like that's the case.
Yeah.
So.
No, it's going to be an ongoing international debate, and I think it'll be interesting to see how it's going to play out in India. Okay. So
I had one other.
Oh, you did. Sorry. Yeah. Okay.
And we can go right up from this into your or into our combined topics.
Oh, I have one that I want to go over.
Is it just yours?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, it's for both of us.
Is it?
But you didn't write down, so I had to. It's about the next steps for the makerspace. We talked about it a lot, and I just
did we?
Yeah,
I'm
in the car.
Amnesia.
Sorry,
I don't remember.
Oh, you don't?
Let's
okay.
do that.
Okay. So, on our trip down to visit our son, we were in the car for 8 hours. And on the way to Fort Benning, because our son just...
In Alabama. No.
No, it's Georgia.
Georgia, sorry.
Just on the border of Alabama.
Yeah. What's Columbus?
Columbus. Yeah. And... it was a great time. He just graduated as an officer from Fort Benning, so we were very excited. And it was a great day. And on the way down,
it was the graduating from the training.
From
course.
The training, yeah, because he had
he
done
was
all
an
of his.
Officer, yeah.
He had all the other stuff done. So on the way down, I started talking to Patrick, which he got amnesia about, about the next step for Smith Makerspace. And what I was trying to figure out is a way to help the students.
I remember.
This
was really
you
good.
Would.
Yeah.
So a way to have students come, have total freedom about what projects they wanted to get involved with, but to somehow have a method of attacking a project if they needed it. So that they could have a step-by-step method for the kids that lacked experience. Because my whole issue is I want more students to come in without the technology experience at home. So I want the kids that don't have someone helping them build things in the garage and that. I want kids to come in and feel they can come in as they are and start where they are. And it's been really challenging. And I know that I get my geeks and my electronic gurus and my programming gurus. They just show up and they're wonderful. They're very energetic. They don't have the opportunity to play and to really work with some equipment and to have the freedom to do it without someone shadowing them at each step.
And you were a bit worried that there was a lack of direction for some of the kids.
Yeah. Yeah. And some kids needed a framework. And they just for comfort, yeah. You know, and I get that. And so Pat and I were brainstorming on the way down. How could we provide a platform for these students so that they have a starting place and to provide encouragement for each person in the group? And Pat came up with this idea of putting together a binder or a folder of different project options. And they would go over and they'd simply pull out, you know, a folder or, you know, a laminated sheet cover and go through it. And they would have step-by-step how to do a simple electronics project or to do a more complicated setup of the Raspberry Pi or whatever it might be.
Yeah. Individual projects.
Individual projects. And they would be ranked, you know, from easy to hard.
Yep.
And so the kids could come over and use them or not.
Yep.
And as they completed these projects, they would earn special stickers. And we would start to put these stickers up and like kind of like a sticker chart, show the kids who've earned the most stickers and whoa ho, look what they've done in the club at lunch. And it's
just important at eighth grade.
It is. There's a certain amount of showmanship that's important.
I kind of saw that as, you know, a fun kind of the flash and trash talking in ballroom dance speak. But I thought that the meat and potatoes was really having that file cabinet with folders, each one with a separate project that's rated, that they can grab a bunch of papers out of there that has a complete project that then they grab it and it's theirs. And
right.
They can write on it and they can fiddle with the stuff and it's all stuff that's been tested there.
And we also thought of giving them either a material list or a box of materials that they can use to finish whatever project that is. And for some, they would have the box because we could put in, you know, the wires, the light bulbs, and all those things to do that simple circuit or series parallel type deal.
Yep.
Or we may have a material list of, wow, you chose to do this project. You earn the Raspberry Pi for the next 3 sessions that we have of the club because you'll need that to complete this project.
Yep.
And for that time, I'm just going to label it with your name.
So, I started working on that?
Yeah.
Remember I told you about the Python?
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to say, I hate Python.
Yes.
But basically, it's because your kids are going to be looking at that type of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much of that out on the web for the Raspberry Pi.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I don't know. I'm coming along. It's going to take me a bit.
And anyway, I think it will be a nice combination where the kids will have choice. And they will have options for developing themselves. And I think that's really important.
I'm really excited for this. I think it's going to work.
I also think that the STEM, the solar, I should call it what it is. So
STEM, solar.
Well, it's the Carolina Biological totally put on this STEM solar car competition.
Right.
And they sent us all the materials free, which kudos to them. I'm so glad they did it because my students really got excited about it.
So I've been going through the podcast trying to make up these outlines. They're not on our website yet, but so that people can search it. Actually, there's some stuff on the website now, but it's a real mess. But we talked about this quite a few times, and I don't know if you remember talking in one of the podcasts.
Yeah.
This could be a, what did I call it? Retour de STEM solar car.
Yeah.
Project. So it was all about the videos.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd worked with the kids to make a video to send in.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard back from?
I did. Yeah. We did not win, but.
It was hard.
It was hard.
You're going against high schoolers.
Right. The high schools won.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually,
but it's neat to have just been part of it as an
eighth
grader.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right? The kids were, of course, disappointed that we did not win.
Yeah. Of course.
Which made me laugh. I'm like, it's okay, you know. You'll have next year. You'll have to totally get a teacher to sign up for it and go for it. And they're like, we're going to. So that's neat. And I hope they totally do that. But
that must be just so heartbreaking for you to work on that. And then because they're going to the high school, you have no way to really help them make sure it happens next year.
I know. Right? And so what I have are about 10 kids that are true geeks and true makers. And they do things at home and they just have a passion for it. And they're going on to high school and we've really developed good skills.
Yeah.
And we've developed a group that is competitive, like really wants to dig in and try new things, but they're pushing themselves, not building a community, not worrying about who, you know, what place they're in. So it's neat because they're always like, "Hey, I just did this, this, and this. Do you know what that is?" And Amr was one of them that was always programming. You come in and tell, but it gave them a platform where they could come and they could share that information with others. And in the regular kind of school conversations or socialization, they wouldn't have had that point, that chance to share. So that makes me sad, and I'm trying to encourage them to make a maker space at the high school.
Does the high school have some kind of a
club? No, they don't. Like this? No.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah. So I've
even... At least they're all gung-ho. And
yeah. So. And I've even said, look, if they don't have one, come and tell me, and I'll set up a club where you'll come after school, because they're just over, you know, at a high school that's... 5-minute walk.
Are they all at the high school that's close by?
Yeah, a lot of them are. Okay. So they can walk over, and I'll give them community service hours for coaching 8th graders.
Oh, that's cool.
So
they could even make some of these projects, right?
Right, right. And you see, and there, that's stuff that I could write onto recommendations as they're going on to college and that.
We need to find a name for these projects.
Yeah.
I keep saying that. Cyclone projects.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's got to be catchy.
Yeah. Yeah. We were trying to think of special names because they have to be cool.
Well, for school, it's the Cyclones, right?
Yeah.
So maybe we need something in there.
Yeah.
Your makerspace, 3 Raspberry Pis, or Pyclone Red, Pyclone Blue, and Pyclone Green. I love those names.
Yeah, anyway, I do too.
It's fun.
Mm-hmm. So that's my topics of interest and
so
something we'll be both digging into.
Yeah. So keeping along with the building and all that type of stuff, engineering, we did several experiments. The one I mostly did was working with the big inductor that I had built to see the effect it had on receiver listening, and I tried different antenna lengths and different amounts of inductance, because when I made the inductant in the inductor, I on purpose did it with many taps on the side, and I built, I think it was around 250 or 260 microhenries, which you can't make a super short antenna into an 80-meter antenna. So 80-meter band, if it's a vertical, it would have to be 1/4 that. So that'd be 20 meters high. But you can make it look resonant to your transmitter. And I thought, you know, that's not going to really make a difference, but the difference was huge. The more inductance I put on there, and I had calculated at 250 microhenries for like a just 2-meter to 3-meter antenna, something in that range would come out to make it resonant, but I didn't think it would help radiation that much. I just thought it would stop some of the signals from bouncing back. So I set up Audacity just like I had, right, with our whole thing on the desk,
right?
And the effect of the inductor, as I increased the inductance, was huge. The effect of changing the antenna length was small, but now I only changed it up to 2.5 meters or so.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about it, I'm only changing the antenna length a small fraction of the amount it would need to be resonant. But I'm changing the inductor the full, you know, how much it would take to make the antenna system resonant. But I thought that would just help in making sure that the signal doesn't bounce back. But I thought it'd just be wasted as heat in there.
Right.
But no, it was radiating a hell of a lot more because the signal was a lot stronger when there was more inductance on the base. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to so I just got some toroids from Amband.
Yeah.
we're going to test those out next to see if you lose a lot of in the toroid, a lot mm-hmm. of energy there, or if you can make a smaller inductor.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, we're going to be running in the woods with it.
Right. So we need something portable that we can run out in place. And you can't carry something that's like 20 pounds or something that's awkward because you're running to ditch it quickly so you can hide them and hopefully run out.
Well, they're not going to be hidden, really.
They aren't really hidden.
Like, we're even going to have a flag. Yeah.
Right. But you don't put them in clear sight. And you're usually running them back in the woods, so it's a little more challenging for people to find.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I did that. And then we were thinking, so then the next part we did together, we set up the antenna. We took it in the car, and we looked for a road that was relatively straight.
Mm-hmm.
And then I set out the antenna at a corner. Actually, you helped out set up the antenna.
Yeah, I did.
But we set up the computer in the back, just running on battery.
Mm-hmm.
And had it recording with Audacity, and we drove away and stopped at different points to take some measurements. And we did not get very far.
We didn't. And
I think we're only somewhere between 500 and 550 meters we lost the signal.
Right, so a half a kilometer away.
So it's a minuscule antenna, and we had no inductor.
Right, right.
But still, though, I thought it was going to be more than that.
Yeah, I had no idea what to expect.
Yeah.
You expected it to be much further, but I just didn't know.
I was hoping it'd be at least over a kilometer.
Yeah, yeah. And
so that was a bit of a bummer.
Yeah. One thing, if you do go out to test an antenna like that, do it early on a Sunday morning, around 6.
Yeah, no kidding.
we went at high shopping hour on Saturday around 12 to 1.
And it took a long time. You'd think it'd be fast, right?
Yeah.
You'd just go up, stop the car, take a measurement. But it took a while.
It did, because when you stop to take a measurement, you have to stop, make sure that you take a minute to set it up. It takes a minute to get off the road to line up where you want to be and that. And so it adds up.
Yep.
It's not that we were in a big rush or anything, but even though you had this clean setup system, it still took time. Like, if you had another system that we would have had to set out things to get the data, it wouldn't have happened.
So there's, do you have any other, so there's several things we have on here. Let me just mention this. The measles story was very interesting.
It was. And
Loki,
I read about it and you read about it.
Loki was interesting.
Yeah, that's the one
new,
I mentioned earlier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have thought the podcast title should have been Loki. But anyway.
I'm sorry.
Loki's the one you got really interested in.
Yeah, I got interested in it last time.
Yeah.
And you were like, But
well,
then
it turns out to be fascinating.
Yeah.
I have to admit.
Well, we were studying about hydrothermal vents. So I was like, whoa, here we are studying about it. And Loki comes along.
And then we have Opa, the fish that's a whole body endotherm.
I thought that was pretty cool.
But you know what?
I think we have to start with measles.
Yeah, but you know what? Check this out. I don't know if look at this.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, we're going to have to wrap up soon.
Yeah. But you know what it is? Last time you were sick.
Yeah.
Well, not last time.
Two times. Three times.
Well, I don't know about the three podcasts, because yeah. they're every 2 weeks.
Yeah. Sort of.
You had problems with your blog.
Yeah.
But before that, you had just a ton of work that came suddenly.
Yeah.
And I did for one of them. And so,
maybe
so
we can
I'm kind of thinking of holding off on these, even though
okay.
there'll be even more news by the next time.
Yes.
And it kills me because we
know
this. But
I know. Yeah. I agree.
But it's already 70 minutes.
Yes. You're right. Right. We should call it.
So maybe future plans will be like...
Future plans.
Discussion of measles, Loki, Archaeota.
Yeah.
The new... What was that thing about? It was in Nature, wasn't it?
Yes.
The article in Nature.
Yeah.
And OPA, the endotherm fish.
Definitely. We have to do that.
But we can't skip future plans.
Yeah.
So... I'm going to do more experiments.
Mm-hmm.
You're finishing school,
I guess. I'm finishing up school, and things are a little crazy right now, so my future plan is to finish well.
I was about to say, you've got your cataract surgery.
Yeah, and so I will be digging into
discussion of cataracts.
Cataracts and cataract surgery.
Okay, we can put it all together.
Yeah.
Measles, Loki, there's archaeobacteria... Fighting measles and warm-blooded fish that have poor eyesight.
How can you go wrong?
Anyway. Yeah, I think that's a lot.
I think it
to
is.
To go over.
Okay, so we'll wrap up this one.
Yep.
And we will be back. And
oh, this kills me to miss
it
these.
It does, because I really like those.
Yeah,
and also,
good.
I wanted to mention the olive trees. I really like that one, the bacteria that's affecting the olive trees.
Okay, I'll write down that down mm-hmm. for you
yeah.
for our next one.
So I'm sure there'll be more news articles that we'll be thinking are the best, too.
That's what hurts the most, because there's so much interesting stuff. And you
yeah.
know by then there'll be stuff that's, oh, look at this.
Yeah.
But anyway. So, so that is it?
That is it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So... Thank you for listening to the Frontal Harvest Podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.